Anya swam through the deep water. She took several pictures of the sailcloth, the skeleton, and the necklace. Two other divers had joined Paresh in the search. While swimming close to the seafloor, they waved their hands and stirred up the loose silt. The effort removed the loose debris and revealed what lay underneath. Unfortunately, the site integrity had already been fouled by the tsunami, so Anya's primary concern was that they didn't miss anything. They'd found two more objects covered in concretion. One of them was probably a cannonball, judging from the shape, but there wasn't any way to tell for certain. Another was an amphora. The container was likely used to transport myrrh, oil, wine, olives, or grain. Anya watched as Paresh and another diver attached lifting bags from the equipment chest they'd brought down to the objects they wanted to take up to the surface. A blast of air to displace the water inside the lifting bag ensured that it would carry to the top, where the men in the support boat would reel them in. Anya took the necklace, 7 gold coins of different sizes, and a ring they'd found. She dropped them into another bag and tied it onto her belt. The fourth diver had bagged the loose bones of the skeleton in a net and was now at work preparing the lifting bag to drift up with its ghoulish collection. The skull rolled loosely at the bottom of the bag as the shifting water currents moved it. Anya stood under the awning on the Casablanca Moon's main deck. Lanterns threw light over the skeletal remains she'd assembled on the folding conference table. She took video of the bones from head to toe. Most of the crew sat around them while the boat rocked at anchor. The dark sea spread out in all directions.
I think the jewelry is Roman.
Why Roman, Lochana?
Because it fits with what we know of the area. Although I'm no expert, I've cataloged a lot of the finds. I believe the profile on this ring is Athena's.
Athena would make it Greek.
Minerva, then. I think I'm more tired than I'd believed possible. Anyway, the style fits with what we've seen of ancient Roman jewelry. It's formed from a hollow hoop that flares out into an oval bezel containing the intaglio of Minerva.
I'd noticed that.
Anya walked over from her side of the table, stopping beside the professor and picking up the ring. She ran her fingertip over the intaglio and felt the depression where it had been carefully excised.
Forgive me, ladies, but I am new at this. What's an intaglio?
Do you have a coin?
I think so. Here.
Usually jewelry and other decorations has an intaglio or cameo styling. A cameo is left when everything else is cut away or an object is deliberately pressed to leave an area higher than the rest of that object, like a coin. See on your coin? That's a cameo.
The depression in the center of the gemstone? That's an intaglio?
Yes. The designer cuts the image out of the material he or she is using.
Anya held up the golden glass pendant. The blue glass bead was teardrop-shaped and held fracture lines that caused it to glint in the light. The double-grooved suspension loop was soldered to the horizontal base plate.
I'd put the ring at 3rd or 4th century, but that necklace, the pendant at least, is older.
How much older?
Probably 1st century BC, maybe a little older. Do you see the intaglio on the side of the bead?
This right here? The carved glass of the centaur wielding a sword? I hadn't noticed that until now.
Have you examined the skeleton?
It's male.
Anya led the way to the skeleton, which sat on another folding table a few feet away. A few of the sailors hadn't been happy about having the remains on the boat. They'd felt the dead man would bring bad luck. Sailors and superstitions, Anya had found, generally went together like waffles and syrup. Anya had been able to determine the skeleton's gender primarily from the hips, but there were other indicators.
He probably stood only a few inches over 5 feet. Judging from the fact that all of his teeth are here, he was probably in his early 20s when he died, maybe only his teens. The xiphoid process has calcified with the rest of the bones.
What's the xiphoid process?
It's a few inches of bone on the sternum. They're one of the last bones that harden in the human body. Forensic anthropologists often use any present flexibility as an indicator of age. However old he was, he'd had some experience fighting. Do you see these three score marks on the bone of the right forearm?
Those are scars from a knife or a sword.
That's what I'd guess. When I was working Hadrian's Wall in England, we studied skeletons and bones that had been recovered from the battlegrounds. There were a lot of wounds like this.
Swords and knives often got past the small bucklers they carried.
Right. Our unknown sailor suffered other damage as well.
What's that there?
Unless I miss my guess, that's an arrowhead.
Iron would have rusted away.
Indeed. We'll have to take samples to know for sure, but I think it's flint.
Flint, eh? Well, judging from this wound and the scarring on the arm, our young sailor was at one time a soldier.
That would be my guess.
Oh, I wish there was some way we could talk to the people we find. The stories they could tell would be amazing.
I know.
Can you imagine living so many years ago?
I can imagine it.
But to be able to experience it, wouldn't that be something?
It really would.
Anya thought about the hundreds of years of history Rue and Garin had locked up in their minds that she couldn't get to. She pushed that thought away. There was another story here.
Well, with no other apparent injuries done to him, I'd say he went down with whatever vessel he was on and drowned.
Oh, I've seen drowning victims before. What a horrible way to die.
Anya started awake, blinking against the harsh sunlight slanting through the window beside her hammock. She knew immediately that she'd slept longer than she'd intended.
Who is it?
It's Paresh, Miss Creed.
What's going on? Is everything all right?
Professor Rai, she wants you to come quickly. She says they have found the ship.
Excitement filled Anya as she stepped up onto the deck. She ran her fingers through her hair and pulled it back into a ponytail. It was later in the morning than she'd thought. The sun was well up and heated air whirled in from the sea. She checked the surrounding water out of habit, expecting their good fortune to have drawn predators. Lochata sat hunkered over the side-scan sonar terminal. The crew stood in a knot around the professor and tried to peer over her shoulder. Shafiq stood nearby with his arms crossed over his chest. His eyes met Anya's and he nodded. A smile stole onto his face. The crew separated at Anya's approach. When she stood at Lochata's back, she peered at the terminal. Revealed in ghostly gray and white, the ship's body lay on the seafloor. It had broken into two pieces, either when it went down or when the tsunami had heaved it back to the surface.
Can you tell what it is, Lochata?
No, not yet. The image is too ill-defined. But you were right about the ship being there, Anya.
We were lucky. It could just as easily have not been there.
But it is.
How far down is it?
100 feet.
Good. We can use normal equipment. I thought it would be out of range.
According to the chart I have, the seafloor is generally 20 feet farther down in this part of the ocean.
20 more feet would put us in a totally different place to do this.
I know. Then you're getting into the realm of commercial diving, and the men you have here aren't trained for that.
I am.
Still, Paresh, that's completely aside from the fact that we'd need different equipment. I guess it's doable.
Despite the impatience that had twisted and turned inside her, Anya had delayed her dive until the water adductor was deployed from the Casablanca Moon's stern. The adductor would help her find more than she could on her own. Paresh, however, wasn't so easily curbed. He had paced the dhow's deck nervously until finally given word to gear up. Also called a water dredge, the adductor was a long metal tube that was used, in effect, like a vacuum hose. Once the seawater started cycling from one end to the other, the flow would continue.
The system is working perfectly.
Okay, everyone. This is it.
Fighting pangs of nervous excitement, Anya sat up on the dhow's railing and pulled her mask tight over her face. Anya and four other divers treaded along the water adductor tube. As they looked down, the ship took form as a dark shape in the water. The high salinity of the water had turned the wooden ship black, but it was better preserved than Anya had thought it would be after all the centuries it had remained trapped on the seafloor. It was a struggle for Anya to keep her breathing normal. If she got too excited, she'd burn through her oxygen in spite of the rebreather. The ship looked like a Roman trade ship. She had a flat deck with a small stern castle and an artaman, a small raking mast at the ship's prow. It had been designed to sail with a beam wind and increase maneuverability. The mainmast had snapped off, and only a broken stump remained. Besides being broken in two, the front half of the ship was upside down at a three-quarter turn. The stern, all but shattered, sat scattered in a mostly upright position. Anya had seen pictures and video of several shipwrecks over the years, but she'd only been able to guess at what finding something like that might be like. Her imagination hadn't even been close. With a shark stick in hand, Anya swam alongside the shipwreck just to get the feel of it. She guessed that it was something over 90 feet long and had a 25-foot beam. Accurate measurements would be hard, given the destruction the vessel had suffered. Anya pulled out her flashlight. Its beam almost disappeared in the murk, but it worked fine as she turned it through a hole towards the inside of the ship. A diver, Paresh, she realized, tried to swim past her into the ship's hold. Anya dropped the flashlight and the shark stick as she grabbed his right leg in one hand and the edge of the hold in the other. She prevented him from entering the broken ship. Angrily, Paresh turned on her and brushed at her hand. Anya caught it in hers, then grabbed his thumb and the edge of his palm in her hands. She twisted the hand into a come-along grip. Paresh spit out his regulator, and a huge air bubble sped towards the surface. Giving into the hold, Paresh rolled backward. He kicked at Anya, but she deflected the effort easily because the water slowed him down. She released her hold and let him swim away. The other divers watched. As Paresh hastily shoved his regulator back into his mouth, Anya slammed her right fist into her left palm and shook her head. Paresh touched his chest with his hands and exploded them outward with the palms facing him, signing, "Why?" Anya took her marker board from her waist. She held her message up clearly for him to see. Not safe. Paresh shook his head. She flipped the board over and wrote on the other side, "Search perimeter first." One of the other divers swam over to Paresh and pulled at his shoulder. With obvious reluctance, Paresh swam off with the other diver. Anya swam to the seafloor and reclaimed her flashlight and shark stick. She pointed the beam into the ship's hold, but didn't try to enter. Silt, sailcloth, and other debris surrounded chests, chains covered with concretion, and amphorae. Anya suspected the ship had been filled with cargo, but it had been spilled across the ocean bed. Most of it was probably lost. There was no real reason to expect that it would be in the vicinity of the ship. The preservation of the ship's corpse was a fluke. If it hadn't been buried in the seafloor, not much of it would have been left. Her curiosity at least somewhat satiated, Anya turned her attention back to the job at hand. She had a sight to work. Fatigued, Anya knew she would have to give up soon. Diving was hard on the body. Barely moving, she hung over the seafloor. They'd gridded the area in foot-wide squares and numbered them accordingly. That in itself had taken a lot of time. She moved the mouth of the water adductor over the seafloor. She didn't get it close enough to suction the sand from the bottom, because that would have defeated the purpose. Instead, she dragged her palm over the sand and caused flurries to rise that were suctioned away. The work was slow and arduous, but it was thorough. If they worked the site properly, it could take weeks. Anya could only hope that Garin had deep pockets, because she didn't intend to quit. Anya's hand came across another amphora. She quickly took pictures with her camera and made a note of the frame numbers and grid location to reference them later. Amazingly, the amphora was intact. There was no way to know what it contained. Anya swam over to the equipment net they'd brought with them and fished out a lifting bag. She tied the lifting bag around the amphora. The lifting bag struggled to be free, then finally floated up toward the surface. As Anya watched, the bag got bigger. The air inside the lifting bag expanded, and for a moment Anya wondered if she'd overfilled it and it was going to burst. Anya relaxed as the bag made it all the way to the top. Tired, Anya turned her attention back to the adductor. "Just one more grid," she told herself. In the next grid, Anya found an oilskin pouch. Brushing away the last bit of debris, she pulled it loose from the sandy ocean bed. It felt curiously light. As she calmly dusted the sand away from the pouch, she saw the end had been curled under and the whole package had been tightly tied. She tied the pouch to a lifting bag. As the bag rose rapidly towards the surface, Anya picked up her shark stick, then slapped her flashlight against it. The heads of the other divers swung toward her. Anya pointed up, then finned toward the surface. Anya hauled herself out of the water and felt immediately chilled. It was dark enough that the lifeboat crews had to use flashlights to find the lifting bags bobbing on the surface. The ones that were too heavy to take out of the water by manpower, like some of the amphorae, were floated into a net waiting at the Casablanca Moon's port side to be winched up later. The sailor in her lifeboat pulled up the lifting bag containing the oilskin pouch. Once the bag cleared the water, it deflated immediately.
"Can I have that?"
The sailor passed over the pouch. Paresh clung to the other side of the lifeboat and gazed at Anya with hot, dark eyes. His anger stained his features. Anya chose to ignore him and turned her attention to the bag. She had trouble untying the knots, but got them at about the time the last of the lifting bags had been dealt with. When she opened the pouch, she found a slim book inside. Intrigued and surprised to find that it was still dry, she pulled it out. It was covered in some kind of leather. That marked it instantly as something the Indian cultures would never have made. When she flipped the book open, she found the script was handwritten, not printed by machine. She couldn't read the language. She wasn't a linguist, and she didn't expect to be able to read everything. What surprised her, though, was the full-color picture on the first page. It was of a beautiful woman. From the top of her head to her bountiful breasts to her trim waist, she was human. But from that point on, she had the body of a snake covered in iridescent blue, green, burgundy, and gray scales.